from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, thousands of students rally around the country to remember those killed in last month's school shooting in Florida and to advocate for gun control. Here in Massachusetts, many students spent a school snow day rallying at the State House.
Enough is enough! Enough is enough!
Also today, Nantucket historian and author Nathaniel Philbrick faces a midlife crisis and sets sail.
In a football game, in a baseball game, you know, the wind is an interfering thing. You know, rain is a pain in the neck. For sailors, the wind and the water is part of the game.
And remembering renowned Boston pediatrician Dr. Barry Brazelton. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, they're being called the biggest student protests since the Vietnam War. Hundreds of thousands of students and their supporters are rallying around the country today to remember the 17 people killed in the Parkland, Florida school shooting 1 month ago today. Here in Massachusetts, various events were held to mark this day of national student walkout. Some students did walk out of their classrooms. Some attended events at their schools. Some events were rescheduled because today is another snow day here in Massachusetts, and some went to demonstrations and rallied at the State House.
We stand in solidarity with victims of gun violence throughout the country!
The State House event was one of the larger events that took place today in Massachusetts. The crowd was somewhat larger than expected because some schools were closed because of the snow. WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin is at our State House office, and he joins us now. Hi there, Max.
Hi, Deb.
So how big was the event at the State House? Describe it for us.
I would say there were clearly hundreds of really energized students. I wonder somewhat if the turnout might have been dampened a bit by snow. There was no school to walk out of, so maybe some people didn't walk out of school. But when they began the morning at Cathedral Church of St. Paul's on Tremont Street, the place was packed both with young people and with a lot of energy, registering to vote and talking through the plan once they got inside the State House.
And it's my understanding that a lot of students met with lawmakers, right?
Yeah, they had actually a three-point agenda. They wanted to see what's called the Extreme Risk Protective Order bill put into effect that would allow mental health officials and law enforcement family members to decide that someone is a risk to themselves or others and to take a gun away. They also wanted to see the state's 20-year-old assault weapons ban upheld in court and defended by lawmakers. And they wanted, kind of interestingly, to see a big education funding equity bill, the foundation budget bill, as it's known, to be passed, because they say that's connected with all of these issues of violence.
When you were talking with these students, Max, do any students say, or a majority of students say, that they feel unsafe?
It was an interesting dynamic. I mean, it definitely felt like a coalition out there. I would say it was an overwhelmingly kind of white suburban turnout. I didn't see or meet a lot of people from Boston Public Schools, for instance, which were closed today. That might have had something to do with it. Most of them told me a version of what we're about to hear, that they feel pretty safe, but they're very attentive to the fact that in Fall River, Lynn, Boston, Springfield, that their guns play a different role in students' lives. For instance, there's this young woman we can hear from now, Laura Lewis. She's a 14-year-old from Medford, and she was sort of audibly grappling with this issue, I thought, if we could hear that.
I don't want our schools to become a prison. I feel like I am safe there, and I want that to be completely true everywhere.
So I think that was something that came up again and again, is that these suburban kids realize that they've been very lucky. Massachusetts has the nation's lowest rate of gun violence, and their communities have particularly low rates, even for the state. But they were drawing connections between the kind of suburban mass school shooting of the kind we saw in Parkland and the kind of day-to-day gun violence that, as they said, affects too many young people in Roxbury or Worcester.
How were the students received?
Well, lawmakers were greeting them with a lot of pride. Pat Jalin, who actually was part of those big youth protests against the Vietnam War, said she was moved in a very deep way by having all these young people sitting and being demanding and asking tough questions of their lawmakers. And people who've been in the movement against gun violence for a long time were similarly impressed by the ardor and the volume these kids brought to today's protest. I spoke to Angus McQuilkin. He's the co-founder of the state's Coalition Against Gun Violence, and he clearly was a bit staggered by the crowd, if we could hear that.
It is my firm belief that this is going to make all the difference. Change happens generationally. We've seen that happen time and again. And here we have a generation of students saying, never again, enough is enough, it's time for this change to happen, this is what we need.
And one of the things that Pat Jalin said to the students here today when she was talking to them was, keep the coalition between yourself and the kids in Boston, keep the connections between things like gun violence and school funding for counselors or psychiatrists in your mind, because those are important connections. And in a sense, don't let this become your only day at the State House.
Okay, WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Deb.
Some students also took their protests to Springfield, Massachusetts today, outside the headquarters of gunmaker Smith & Wesson. That's the manufacturer of the gun that was used in the Parkland school shooting. With us now is Nakia Jean Charles, a freshman at Cathedral High School in Boston. She is at the rally at Smith & Wesson, which is happening right now. Nakia, can you tell us what's going on there?
Hi. So there's a huge crowd outside, a bunch of news reporters, and we've been chanting, Smith & Wesson, meet with us.
Okay, why did you want to go to Smith & Wesson? Tell us.
Oh, we wanted to make a solution to Smith & Wesson, that we wanted, one, a meeting with the youth. Two, we wanted a solution about gun reform and how these assault weapons shouldn't be sold to citizens. And the guns that were used at the Parkland shooting was at M&P, which is for military and police. That's not for regular citizens to have with them.
How many people would you say are there?
100. Like, it's getting bigger because we have other students that are Springfield students that are getting out of school right now.
Mm-hmm. Are there teachers there as well, the grown-ups?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there a speaking program? Are folks going to be speaking?
Yeah, we brought a bunch of speakers with us so everybody can hear us clearly.
Mm-hmm. And essentially what you want to do is call on Smith & Wesson to stop manufacturing these type of assault weapons that were used in Parkland and other high-profile shootings. Is that right?
Yes, and we want a meeting with the youth.
And you want a meeting with them. How long will you stay there?
What did you say?
How long will you stay there?
Oh, we're going to be here from 3 to 6.
All right. Nakia Jean Charles, a freshman at Cathedral High School in Boston, thanks very much for being with us.
No problem.
I want to introduce some folks who are with us in studio now to talk about this. Jack Schneider is an assistant professor of education at Holy Cross, and he's been with us before. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Amalia Hochman, a sophomore at Somerville High School. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So you were one of the students at the State House today, Amalia.
Yes, I was there.
So what was it like?
It was incredible to see so many kids from all over coming in for this collective goal to stand in solidarity with the Parkland kids, to get these bills passed, and to really say enough is enough, and we got to make the difference now.
Hmm. We heard from Max Larkin, our reporter at the State House. He said it was a bunch of energized students. Did you feel that there was a lot of energy? What was the mood like?
Yeah, there's a lot of energy in the crowd, especially on the steps of the State House when we were chanting. And it was just incredible. I was standing on the steps looking down at everybody else, and everybody was excited, ready to get these things passed, and really ready to go talk to our lawmakers and tell them what we think they should be doing with the gun control in this country.
Why do you want to be involved in this? Why is this issue inspiring to you?
Well, starting off with the Parkland kids, seeing them come together and rally for more comprehensive gun control was an incredible inspiration. This is definitely a huge issue for my generation. And to be honest, it has been for generations before me, but it's increasing. The amount of gun deaths are increasing, and it's also were finally stepping out and saying, this has to stop. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to sit by while 7 kids a day in the U.S. are killed by guns. And I'm not going to sit by and let especially communities of color be targeted by gun violence. And I want to stand up and I want to stand in solidarity. And I want to make sure that this country and these schools and our streets are safer for the generations to come.
Hmm. Jack, what do you make of this organizing and these huge protests today?
I think one of the things that it speaks to is the fact that this generation is the generation that has come of age and feeling like school shootings are something that can happen to them. You know, we're about almost 20 years out from Columbine, and I've got a second grader who does lockdown drills as a part of her school experience, right? Mm-hmm. Times have changed, and this generation of high school students is really the generation that has come of age with this ever-present reality. And unfortunately, it is ever-present. It's a part of, you know, their lived experiences in a small number of cases, but it's a part of the broader culture for them, that this is something that can happen in schools. And of course, school shootings are as old as schools are, but the technology has changed. And so if you go back in the historical archive and you look at the number of deaths caused by each school shooting, we're talking about 1 or 2, unless somebody has used a bomb, and we're not talking about a school shooting when we've got a bomb. Now we're talking about bomb-level deaths when somebody is bringing an assault rifle into a school.
Right. You know, we've seen some movement, though, legislatively, right? We've seen some movement in Florida, right? A little bit of movement there. We've heard about President Trump. We're not quite sure. He said that there may be some changes to gun laws, or there may not be. But there does seem to be movement. Can you directly attribute that movement, Jack, to what these students are doing? Do they change the conversation?
Absolutely. I mean, I just look at some of the pushback that they've encountered, where people are trying to dismiss them, or people are trying to say that the students are puppets who are being controlled by, you know, adult interests. And the fact is that that's the best kind of criticism you can mount against them. And it's not very effective, because these students have a direct experience. They are the ones who are being affected by this, and they speak really powerfully and really compellingly about this. It's really hard to tell a young person, no, you do not get to speak up for your own safety or the safety of your peers. Mm-hmm. And while it's true that, you know, it's a very small minority of students who die at the hands of gun violence inside their schools, it's something that is that can be fixed, right? It's not something that they need to live with.
Right. I want to play a cut here that got a lot of attention on social media. It's Florida State Representative Elizabeth Porter. And during gun control debate in Florida, she asked her colleagues why lawmakers should listen to children. This is what she said last Tuesday.
Are there any children making laws? Do we allow the children to tell us that we should pass a law that says no homework? Or you finish high school at the age of 12 just because they want it so? No. The adults make the laws because we have the age, we have the wisdom, and we have the experience.
So I'm wondering, Amalia, when you hear her say that, what do you think?
I think what she's saying is ridiculous, because if she's making the laws, then why isn't she keeping us safe? And it's not that we're out here saying no homework. We're out here fighting for our lives and fighting for the lives of other students.
Jack, your thoughts?
Well, I just turned back the clock to the Vietnam War protests, right? Why was it that we saw youth leading the charge against the war? It's because they were the ones being affected by it. And I think it's very hard to make a compelling case against young people speaking out against this issue, because they are the ones who are being directly affected by it. And they're going beyond that in terms of making calls for broader protections against gun violence. But at the end of the day, the core issue is one that comes out of their experience, not the lived experience of a disconnected legislator in Florida who does not respect the lives of young people.
I wonder, Amalia, do you feel unsafe in your school, or were there safety issues that prompted you to focus on this issue and become a leader in this in particular?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question, and it's one that comes up for debate a lot in my school. I know the day after the Florida shooting, a lot of people felt like they weren't safe and that we could be next and that it seemed like it really could be a reality. I also know we live in Massachusetts and we have some of the strongest gun laws. However, 2 kids at the beginning of this year in Somerville were shot and killed. My house has been shot at. So it definitely...
It has.
Yeah, a couple years ago.
Just sort of a random
some drunk guy in the middle of the night just open fired. But so it definitely is a reality that at least kids in Somerville do see. However, we do know still we are in Massachusetts and we do have these strict gun laws. So it's a funny balance.
Right. Jack, what do you say to folks who say Massachusetts already has laws? Why do we need to do this here? Do we?
One of the young people who was killed in Somerville was my daughter's swim teacher. And so, you know, what I would say that it actually doesn't matter how small the number is. As long as there's a number, it's something that we should take action on. And that in taking action locally, right, it can also lead to us taking action on a national level. And so we have a national problem here in terms of gun violence. And I'm inspired by seeing young people trying to get active in the most immediate way they can, but I'm even more inspired by the thought that this is going to get them hooked into bigger national conversations where they can begin to change the dialogue that we basically haven't been having around guns.
I want to bring some other students into the conversation right now. Some of the students who did walk out as scheduled this morning. On the line with us is Sherilyn Strader. She's a junior at Northampton High School. Hi there, Sherilyn.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay, tell us what happened in Northampton today.
Today in Northampton, we walked out at 10 a.m. and we had a pretty big group. We had four students from our school speak about student anxiety and what we can do to take action after the walkout on a federal level and on a state level. And we had 17 students come up and read a blurb about the students and staff who died in Parkland, and we sort of expressed how people's lives are being fit into one sentence as victims of shootings and how we're not doing anything about it, and that we should be trying to prevent fitting people into one sentence in the future.
Why did you want to get involved in this?
I was inspired to get involved with this by the leadership that the Parkland students took. I think, personally, I haven't experienced gun violence in my community, but I have watched shootings occur my entire life, and I've always questioned why nothing was being done. And so the leadership the students in Parkland took made it super easy for us to get involved here.
Students at Northampton were also encouraged to register to vote. Is that right?
Yeah. Today we had voter registration tables at lunch, and we're doing the same thing tomorrow.
So it's not over, even though the event might have been over this morning. You're still continuing.
Yeah, we're still continuing in our school, and we also are continuing to organize a march on the 24th in our community as well.
That's the National Student March on March 24th. Is that right?
Yeah, we're organizing the Pioneer Valley March for Our Lives in our community.
Do you think you're making a difference?
I hope so. I hope that the work that we're doing is inspiring people to join us. I know today we've gotten lots of comments and messages saying that people were proud of the work we're doing and that they were excited to join us on the 24th.
Okay. Sherilyn Strader, a junior at Northampton High School, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, I want to bring in the voice of a school administrator, because we haven't heard from folks who are in a leadership role and a grown-up role in the school. And this is, no offense to you, I'm not saying you're not a grown-up, Amalia, but I mean adult, over the age of 21. And this administrators have said, at least publicly to the media, that they're in a tough spot here, right? They're trying to strike a balance between allowing students to be able to express themselves freely, but they don't want to take a position that might offend people because they're public school, right? So they can't go on one side or the other. Diane Kelly is the superintendent in Revere. Diane, thanks for being with us.
No problem. I'm happy to be here.
So you encourage students to participate in these protests. You alerted them on Twitter last night. Why is that?
Well, the kids actually came to us and said that they, you know, a couple of weeks ago and said that they wanted to have an action on the 14th. And, you know, we decided that it is in our best interest and their best interest and the best interest of our community to support their efforts rather than try to thwart them. So the kids really did all of the planning. They arranged the event. They had something else designed prior to the blizzard. And we met on Monday, and they had some different ideas on what are we going to do if there's no school on Wednesday, which came to be the reality, and that's where the idea came to still engage in the action, but use City Hall as a meeting space for kids throughout the city instead of our five separate high schools and middle schools. Mm.
So how many kids showed up at City Hall? What happened?
So we had about 4 dozen people there, a handful of kids. The kids did an awesome job. We had a moment of silence. A couple of kids read statements about their beliefs regarding gun control and politics across the country. We had three students who did a spoken word piece that was amazing. And everybody just kind of came together and expressed the idea that we're here to support what the kids want to do. I know the kids themselves had wished that more students had come, because I'm sure if it had been a school day, we would have had a higher participation rate. But I still felt like it was fantastic that they had a couple of dozen kids there.
What do you make of what we're hearing from some folks who say that school administrators and teachers have to be careful? They have this line here. We did hear from Tom Scott, who's the executive director of the Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents. He actually told the Boston Globe that he said, you know, perhaps superintendents should try to divert students from focusing on gun control. It's a politically charged issue. So, you know, that maybe there should be a larger agenda of school safety sort of in general here, because you can't really take a stand or a political position on an issue. What do you say to that, Superintendent Kelly?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. I mean, even we had other students, we had the main group of students who initially wanted to demonstrate in support of the families in Florida and elsewhere around the country who have endured these horrific tragedies. But we had another group of students that emerged a little bit later after the planning process started who wanted to lobby in favor of gun rights. And so we engaged those kids as well. Their voice is equally important. And, you know, that's, I think, the important message for the kids, is that you can have a civil dialogue with people who don't agree with your position on things. I think that what everybody can agree with, and I know that both groups of students told me this, is they want to feel safe in school. And so I think, to Tom Scott's point, if the middle ground that we can all find together is, let's find a way to make sure our kids are safe in school and not just make it be about, you know, the politics that come behind that, and not let the politics prevent progress, then we'd all be a lot better off, and the kids would be a lot better off, and that's what's really important.
Diane Kelly, Superintendent of Schools in Revere, Massachusetts, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to turn now to our in-studio guests. Jack Schneider, what about teachers and administrators trying to find that balance here? What would you say about that?
I would actually say that this movement will be even more powerful if teachers and administrators don't make special accommodations for students, and if students take action on their own, if they show that they are willing to face the consequences because actually this matters a tremendous amount to them. That's really compelling. A colleague of mine, John Zimmerman, who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, encouraged students in Philadelphia to go on strike. What would be more powerful than students shutting down effectively a sector of the economy because parents maybe don't feel like they can go to work because their kids are refusing to go to school, that schools, which serve 50 million young people, effectively can't operate because the students aren't showing up. That's when you start to see real change, when young people or anybody is really investing their time and taking some risks in standing up for what they believe in.
You know, there have been a lot of comparisons to Vietnam. Is this really a comparison to Vietnam? Have we ever seen students this young, really, kind of getting involved in this and taking action like this?
We have historically. You know, one case that jumps to mind for me is the blowouts in Los Angeles, which actually were half a century ago. 50 years ago, students in East Los Angeles walked out for about 5 days. And so we had thousands of students who were refusing to go to school because the demands that they were making for an equal education were not being met. You know, we've seen this kind of student protest before from middle school, high school students in East Los Angeles. They were really effective. Now, these students were labeled as being, you know, violent and disruptive. They were pegged as being controlled by adult interests. But again, what we see is that that criticism was not enough to undermine the core message, which was that students had an experience, and that experience was their education was not equal, and that made them powerful, the fact that they could share that experience and that they were willing to take to the streets on it.
We've heard, there were today's events. We've heard about the event on March 24th, right, Jamalia? There will be that. You're organizing that as well.
Yeah, I'm helping with the team.
And what's happening there?
So we're going to, have a rally downtown, and we're just going to keep pushing our agenda. And one big thing about today and going forward is that this is just the beginning, and we're not going to stop. And so on the 24th, we're just continuing that.
So we've got the 24th event. We've got today's event. Some schools are doing different things. Some schools are really focusing on gun control. Some say it's more about the Parkland victims. Just historically, does there need to be more unification for this to produce results like maybe the ones in Los Angeles or things like that? Do you think unity is an issue here, Jack?
I would say there's actually a risk in young people having their movement co-opted, being brought into the fold where, the demonstration suddenly is a sponsored demonstration that has been tamed by school administrators, or where the demands of young people are being used to back a bill that does not necessarily align with the demands that they're making. You don't end up getting where you want to be by compromising from the get-go. And so I would say I would encourage young people to actually lay out all of what they demand, lay out their demands and stand up for their demands, and then push them as far as they could possibly get them, because we've had a couple decades of total inaction on this issue and some just absolutely egregious cases where it seemed like we were going to see some action and we didn't. And so I would say to young people, this is not the time to compromise. This is the time to stand up and to stake out your claim on this issue, which affects you, but which affects everybody really in the United States.
Amalia, last word goes to you. Just overall, how do you feel after today's events? You said this isn't the end. Yeah. This is the beginning. You're going forward. You said you were energized. You agreed with Max's description there at the beginning. So where do you stand right now? What happens?
I feel incredibly empowered. To see so many students nationally coming together for the same goal, I think is incredibly powerful. I think we all know that we can't stop fighting and we can't back down because we have to change this. This wasn't changed for us when it should have been a long time ago when this first became an issue. And I don't think that I'm definitely not going to back down, and I know that my peers aren't going to either, because we know that we have to change this now.
All right. Amalia Hochman, a sophomore at Somerville High School, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with us in the studio today was Jack Schneider, an assistant professor of education at Holy Cross and director of research for the Massachusetts Consortium for Innovative Education Assessment. Thanks so much, Jack.
Thanks for having us.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Author Nathaniel Philbrick is probably best known for his historical narratives like In the Heart of the Sea, the National Book Award winner about the tragedy of the whale ship Essex. But in his newest book, Philbrick turns his literary talents on himself. He's just published a memoir exploring his relationship with the sea and his local ponds of Nantucket. It's titled Second Wind, A Sunfish Sailor, An Island, and the Voyage That Brought a Family Together. Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
And so you decided to write a memoir this time. Why is that?
Well, sailing has always been very important to me. One of my earliest memories is being on a sailboat. And after we moved to Nantucket years ago, I was a stay-at-home dad. And as a stay-at-home dad, kind of lost touch with sailing, which had once meant everything to me. I was a Sunfish North American champion back in 1978. And so I decided to to launch a comeback. And in doing that, I decided I wanted to get at what was happening. You know, water is important to me. Water has been important to my history books. And so this was a way to sort of get at where I'm coming from, both as a writer and as a sailor.
Mm. And so what did you get at?
You know, it's one of those things that when I was doing all this back in the 92, 93, I was just doing it. And I really wasn't sure why or, you know, what was happening. But looking back, I can see that water was the catalyst with which I was able to find my voice as a historian. Because while I was launching this comeback as a sunfish racer, I was working on my first work of history, a history of Nantucket, away offshore. And the two were proved to be absolutely intertwined. And I would actually sail to places I was researching and writing about. And since then, even when I'm writing a book about Custer's Last Stand in Montana, that book begins with a riverboat. And so water is always been important to me.
Huh. You know, you're sailing here in this book on a sunfish, and you wrote, if an America's Cup boat is a Ferrari, a sunfish is a VW bug.
Absolutely.
So what do you like about using the sunfish?
Oh, the sunfish is the greatest sailboat, I think, ever designed. I mean, it's basically an 13.5-foot ironing board, bloated a little bit with a well in the middle of it for your feet. They have a sail that's shaped like an isosceles triangle. It's a Latine rig. And they might not look like much, but they're fast. And they're very adaptable. One person can sail them. You can get a crowd on board them. And when it comes to racing them, kids can race against adults, people of all sizes. So for me, it's accessible sailing. And what's great about it being so small, if you can learn to sail on a sunfish, you can sail any boat because it's such an intimate relationship with the water and the wind that you develop a sensitivity that you just wouldn't get in a bigger, heavier boat. So I just can't say enough about a sunfish.
Mm. And you also write in the book about what it's like to be out on the water. You describe a part of sailing where you get it, where everything becomes aligned, and you call it equipoise. Could you read that part of the book for us?
Yeah. And this is just to give it some context. I was practicing for the North Americans, and in this session I sailed out of Nantucket Harbor to the jetties where all the seals are. And I went seal watching. This was in the winter, actually, and the seals started following me. And it was an interplay that really brought me to what I was trying to achieve by sailing, and I owed it a lot to the seals. Sailors have a word to describe the sensitivity required to achieve this perfect equipoise. It's called feel, and to a certain extent, you either have it or you don't. I've seen a professional baseball player, a superb athlete with absolutely no feel, become so disoriented during a routine day sail that he slipped and fell out of a boat. I've seen a 58-year-old woman with a bad hip step into the same sailboat that gave the baseball player such trouble and be immediately at home. Instead of unnerving her, the unsteadiness of the water and the flukiness of the breeze liberated her from the cruel grasp of dry land and gravity that forced her to walk with a cane. She intuitively understood and was delighted by the way sailing reinvented the playing field. The athlete, on the other hand, wanted no part of it. More than anything else, feel is a matter of empathy with wind and water. Whereas most sports deny nature altogether, a sailor cannot escape it. As long as the wind fills the sails, he or she is consorting with a force beyond human control. But feel doesn't emanate from a higher spiritual plane. On the contrary, it is primitive, elemental. Feel reaches back into the marrow and the synapses, into the brine of the bloodstream. Everything is reduced to instinct. As I sail, I'm a throwback to an earlier evolutionary stage. I am very like a seal.
It's beautiful. When you're sailing, do you have to get to that point of feel, of equipoise?
Yeah, and you know, this is part of what I was trying to figure out if I could still do it. When I was 22 years old, when I won the North Americans, I could slip into that state quite easily. You know, I had my life was relatively simple when I look back. Now, at this point, when the year I'm describing, I was 36 years old. I was at home with young children. I was writing a book, and life was a little more complicated. And my question was, could I get back to that? Mm. And so the book is, in many ways, can I find feel again? And it was this sale with the Seals that I first got it back after several weeks of trying. And what I found was I could momentarily grasp it, but I couldn't live in that zone the way I had when I was younger.
Why is that?
You know, that kind of feel and zone is something, you know, you just have to let it go in a way. And I was always, you know, life was always intruding, but it would come back. And so it was a flickering thing. And so what I realized, you know, this is I love it when I feel this way. And so I really still owe that year so much. I'm now 61 years old and I still love to sail. And it's when I feel it's coming back.
Why is it that the athlete doesn't feel the feel, but the 58-year-old woman with a bad hip can, as you write? What is it about the feel that attracts different people?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Great sailors are not necessarily great athletes, but what they have is this kind of instinctive sense of oneness with the wind and water. Mm-hmm. In a football game, in a baseball game, you know, the wind is an interfering thing. You know, rain is a pain in the neck. For sailors, the wind and the water is part of the game. You know, you are competing against others, but it's really the wind and the water. That's what I like about sailing, not being a very particularly coordinated person myself. It really moves me to a place that makes me refreshed and sort of makes me feel at one with the universe.
There were parts of the book where you write about some pretty harrowing experiences. Yeah. Where, if you read them at first blush, not to be insulting or anything, they're kind of reckless, some
yes.
of the things you did to see if you could do this again,
right?
however many years later. Why do you think you took that path? Was it adrenaline, or what was it about that?
Right. It was kind of, you know, teenage behavior. You know, really stupid, but oh, man, what a rush. I mean, you know, I had spent 10 years in a very intensely domestic situation at home with the kids. Mm. And I think I was having a kind of midlife crisis. I really just wanted to sort of break out. And so it was kind of juvenile looking back. And, you know, I think I was just working some things out in a way. Now I'm just, you know, a little bit more laid back, a little bit more.
Is your writing process different when you write a memoir? Like how is it different?
It is. You know, when I write a history, it's a 3-year process, a year of research, a year of writing, and a year of basically editing. Memoir for me was I took notes as I sailed the ponds and trained for the regatta and collected them all and then sat down to write and wrote something that was probably 3 times the length of the book we have now. And for me, it became a process of cutting and realizing how much better it was getting as I took out the more self-indulgent parts and really told a story. And for me, it was a process of finding what was the story what was unfolding during that year. And so looking back, you know, I'm proud of the book.
What's the main message you would want people to take from the book?
Yeah, I think the main message is, you know, as parents, we make a lot of sacrifices for our kids because they are everything. But you run the risk of kind of losing who you are. And at some point, you need to recognize your needs along with the kids' needs. Otherwise, the kids will suffer. And so for me, this was a year of I had sort of overcompensated on the domesticity side. I needed something more for me to keep going forward in a positive way. And that happened that year. And it was kind of revelatory.
Author Nathaniel Philbrook, his latest book is the memoir Second Wind, A Sunfish Sailor, An Island, and the Voyage That Brought a Family Together. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at the Paul Pratt Memorial Library in Cohasset. Nathaniel Philbrook, thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, remembering renowned pediatrician Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, who told parents to listen to their babies because babies probably know more than most of us think. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, it may not be this season, but there's been quite a bit of news involving the New England Patriots this week. Joining us for our weekly sports segment is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Deb.
So some of the news this week involved the Patriots roster. Receiver Danny Amendola appears headed to Miami to play for the Dolphins. And here's Tom Brady in October of last year talking about how impressed he was with Amendola's plays during a game with the Panthers.
Yeah, I have a ton of confidence in him. I always have. It's just, and it always keeps growing. I mean, we played together for a long time, and he's such a clutch player.
So is this a surprising move, Bill?
Well, I guess it's a surprising move to Tom Brady. Amendola, of course, has had a reputation of being spectacularly dependable, especially when it matters most in the postseason and on occasion in various Super Bowls as well. It's not surprising in terms of the context of the whole National Football League because this is what athletes do. They look around and attempt to maximize the bottom line for the brief period of time that they have because playing
unless
careers,
you're Tom Brady.
Even Tom Brady. I mean, he's been in the happy situation of making top dollar pretty much by staying in one place. But that's not the case for a lot of other players.
Aside from Amendola, though, we heard about Deion Lewis and Malcolm Butler, tentative deals with Tennessee. What do we take of those moves? Same thing here, Bill?
You don't know what to make of any of these moves, of course, until you see what the team that's going to take shape over the course of the draft and various acquisitions, what that team's going to look like next season. The one that bothers me more than the guys that you have mentioned, useful as they are, is Nate Solder. He is, according to information that I got just a few hours ago, going to sign a gigantic contract with the New York Giants. And this is the guy who has the primary responsibility of keeping defensive players away from Tom Brady. So unless the Patriots are ready to put somebody else in that position who's as good as Nate Solder has been at protecting Brady, I would say Brady might be even more concerned about his loss to the Giants than the ones you have mentioned.
And, of course, we've got Gronkowski, too, still no contract.
Yeah, and that's a great problem because you always want players who are going to entertain the fans, win or lose, and Gronkowski can certainly be counted on to do that.
But does any of this mean anything about the team's relationship with Brady?
There's lots of speculation about who has the power now. Is it Kraft? Is it Brady? Is it Belichick? Is there some sort of shift in terms of who's able to call the shots and who gets listened to? Again, I am not inside the heads of any of those people, so I don't really know. But there has to be some realization, some recognition that fit as he is and successful as he has been at what is a very advanced age for an NFL quarterback, Tom Brady is an old NFL quarterback, and people have to be thinking to some extent, people in the organization have to be thinking to some extent that he isn't going to last forever. So perhaps he doesn't have the same sort of influence that he had, say, 5 years ago.
Now let's talk about this class action lawsuit that we've heard about regarding football players, Patriots specifically. 42 team members have alleged that they experienced symptoms of brain injuries caused by repetitive head impacts.
42 of the players who were on those of the 100 players that were on those most recent teams that
title
won Super
teams,
Bowl. So
right.
This is not guys who are in their 50s.
Right.
This is guys who were in their 30s.
Right. So what does it mean, do you think, that these players are coming forward, the 42 of these 100 who were on these three title teams that are in this lawsuit about brain injuries? What does it mean, Bill?
Well, a lot of these guys, we were aware that they were on the list of people who were in the concussion lawsuit. Some of them have experienced symptoms of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, memory problems, pain, mood swings, depression, etc. Mm-hmm. And some of them have simply signed up because they anticipate that it's very likely that they will anticipate some of these symptoms somewhere down the line, and they want to be in the right place at the right time to be eligible to collect for that, or for their families to be able to collect. But the striking thing about Bob Holder's article on Sunday, which is the story to which you were referring, is that he puts all these people together. He suddenly confronts Patriots fans with the fact that this is a big number of players. And some of these guys are among the most popular and most accomplished Patriots in the history of the franchise. And so, you know, it's not just the poor, unfortunate lineman who's hit his head against another lineman a whole lot of times. It's guys who made the team what it is and who are now suddenly faced with significantly diminished lives, and, you know, some of them, as I say, in their 30s, and people who are saying, well, you know, I like to sit in a quiet, dark room by myself because some days I can't figure anything out at 35. How many days like that is he going to have when he's 50? And this is the thing that's scary about Mr. Holder's article that came out Sunday.
Right. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. You can listen every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. here on WBUR. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Deb.
We want to take some time today at the end of our show to remember world-renowned pediatrician Dr. T. Barry Brazelton. He died at his home in Barnstable yesterday. He was 99 years old. Dr. Brazelton, sometimes known as the baby whisperer, was fascinated by the bond between babies and parents. He maintained that parents should be encouraged to intuitively develop a relationship with their children by paying close attention to what their youngsters were trying to express. Here's what Dr. Brazelton said on this show back in 2010.
And the truth is that parents really have it in them. They know what they can do, and they know what fits for them. And if they don't, they can look to the baby, and the baby will tell them what to do. So between the two, it's really better to let them find their way.
Dr. Brazelton practiced in Cambridge for decades. He taught here and around the world. He was professor emeritus at Boston Children's Hospital. And joining us to help remember him is Dr. Kevin Nugent. He's founder of the Brazelton Institute at Boston Children's Hospital. Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Nugent.
Thank you very much, Deborah. I'm just delighted to be here.
So tell us about Dr. Brazelton's effect on the field of pediatrics. I know that's probably a graduate level class, but could you tell us briefly for a radio program?
Well, I think above all, he really was the one who introduced family-centered care by including the whole family in the examination of the baby. So the idea of bringing the baby to a separate room, he felt was inappropriate. So the baby and parents were all together when he worked with them. But the second thing he did that nobody else had done before is actually assume the baby has something to say, could communicate his needs. So one of the tools he developed was the Newborn Behavioral Assessment Scale that people have used around the world to really allow us to focus on the baby, not just the baby in a physical way, but the baby as a person. And that was, I think, Barry's great creative genius. Helped us understand that every baby has something to say. If we could just about read these cues.
Is that the main piece of advice that you think he gave you that stays with you even now?
I think so, and I think it's the fact not to teach parents. He felt the only teacher in the room was the baby. If we could learn from the baby, then it would free parents up to look at their baby more closely and not feel burdened to have to come up with all the answers themselves. Mm-hmm. The answers laid in getting to know your baby as well as possible. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, in a very non-judgmental way, that was Barry's great role.
Mm-hmm. Where did this desire to help children and recognize his talents with infants and babies, where did it come from? Do you know?
That's a good point. He always said that his dad and mom said he was very good with children. Mm. He was just very good with other children. And so he went into pediatrics. But I think he was primarily a clinician. And when he first worked with parents here in Boston, when he first brought out his book in 1969, Infants and Mothers, it was probably the first book that said that babies were different from the very beginning. There were easy babies, challenging babies, etc. And this went away from the mother-blaming. He really had a mission in life to move away from the mother-blaming approach and somehow to be supportive of mothers, as you said in that clip earlier, to allow mothers to trust in their own intuitive capacity to understand their own baby.
I want to play another clip from the 2010 interview on Radio Boston. There's a little bit of music under this. And this was how Dr. Brazelton responded when he was asked what he hoped his legacy would be. Let's listen.
Lovely, yes.
Well, I hope it'll be that it's the most wonderful opportunity you ever have, and that the child is such a glorious outcome. And if you do the right things, you both have a wonderful, wonderful time.
Oh, that's beautiful. That is the capacity for human sympathy. That's really what I think that, as our director Lenny Rappaport at the hospital said today, it was his, the capacity to ask questions throughout his life. And kept listening and wondering.
Listening and wondering and listening to the babies.
Absolutely, yes.
Dr. Kevin Nugent from Boston Children's Hospital, founder of the Brazelton Institute. Thanks for being with us today to remember Dr. Brazelton.
It was my pleasure and privilege, Deborah. Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.